This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. I'm going to do a slightly different podcast today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of the wider context of a particular period of time, and that is Europe in the immediate aftermath of the war. The reason why I want to talk about this is I have quite a few students at the moment who are looking at the Cold War, and if you understand the situation that Europe is in 1945, it helps to give a kind of a broader background to understanding an awful lot about the decisions that were made and the view, not just of the Allied powers, but also of the Soviets, on what was possible in Europe in 1945. And again, this kind of context can help inform our understanding of the decisions that are made in the very early moves of the Cold War. The point I'm going to make now might seem slightly odd, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that the Second World War was experienced by far more civilians than it was soldiers. The countries of Europe occupied from 1940, or in Poland's case 1939, and in Western Europe 1940 up until 1944, the majority of people there who experienced the war are civilians, and the bulk of devastation, the vast majority of lives lost in Europe, happens in a very short space of time, really from June 1944 all the way through to May 1945. And it is the civilians' experience of the post-war era, from beginning in 1945, that's most telling and important. If you go all the way back to the various discussions that Hitler had in the 1930s with his generals, specifically things like the Hossbach Memorandum, the discussion recorded by Colonel Friedrich Hossbach of the debates between Hitler and his chiefs of staff on the course of the war and planning for the war, it becomes clear that a war of plunder was always intended. Hitler's answer to the seemingly irreconcilable German economic problems of the 1930s was that conquest would pay for itself, that Germany would become rich at the expense of occupied neighbours. And those neighbours would be forced to exist on a lower standard of living. And the results of this plunder, which becomes intensified as the war goes on, and the crises of Germany's failed war means that she needs to resort to ever more drastic measures in appropriating slave labour and indentured labour and looting the economies of the occupied powers. It means that you have an immensely impoverished Europe at the end of the war, and it also means that you have enormous numbers of displaced peoples. By 1945, it was estimated that some 25 million people across Europe were homeless, the result of aerial bombing and the devastation of both the German Red and the Allied armies, and the scale of destruction of basic things like animals and livestock was breathtaking. Half the livestock of, say, Yugoslavia was destroyed. And the toll on infrastructure is an equivalent amount of unbelievable devastation. 70,000 villages in the Soviet Union and 1,700 towns. There were 32,000 factories destroyed and 40,000 miles of rail track destroyed. Two-thirds of the merchant marine force in Greece destroyed. Two-thirds of France's shipping destroyed. And the costs of occupation on the countries across Europe is inestimable. The mental toll of war is obviously very hard to quantify, but in 1945, from France all the way through to Russia and from Norway down to Greece, there are people wearied and exhausted by war, people who are traumatised perhaps for the rest of their lives by the experience of war. When you consider statistics that Berlin, in the final 2 weeks of the war, experienced 40,000 tons of artillery shells landing upon it, it is understandable the scale of human death. But the experience of Berliners and then the experience of occupation by the Red Army with the million or so rapes and acts of sexual violence that go with it make it almost impossible, really, for us to have a realistic sense of the experience of survivors. One can only really imagine what those people eventually felt or experienced when the ravages of the most extreme phase of the war were over. The rest of Europe, however, is not very much different in 1945 to Germany herself. Some 5 million Poles had been killed during the duration of the war, 1.4 million Yugoslavs, 350,000 French, 270,000 Hungarians, 430,000 Greeks, 204,000 people in the Netherlands, and 200,000 Romanians. And, of course, some 5.7 million Jews and 220,000 Roma. In the Soviet Union, there were some 27 million war dead, of which about 8 million were soldiers and the remaining were Soviet civilians. It was only really through the intervention of the new United Nations that mass epidemics in Europe are avoided. It was entirely possible that in 1945... a repeat of the post-war Spanish flu might have taken hold. The United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, which was the first widespread aid organisation to accompany the Allied occupying armies, encountered extraordinary scenes of hunger and deprivation. In Vienna, the average calorie intake per day is just a little bit over 800 calories. And if you imagine a normal adult male in Britain today probably consumes an awful lot more, but should consume something like about 2,300 calories to break even, you get an idea that the degree of hunger that Hitler's wars had resulted in. In Germany as well, calorie intake had fallen by 1,000 calories between 1941 and 1945, so from 2,400 to a little over 1,400. And this was good eating in comparison with places in the Balkans like Greece and Yugoslavia. The widespread destruction of farms and the loss of horses, which had been commandeered for war, the German army continued to go to war through even into the invasion of Russia with a predominantly horse-drawn army, meant that there was an immense amount of hoarding. Those that could grow food had little trust in their local currencies, and they could see greater value in their produce by hoarding it instead of selling it, that produce that there actually was. I think there's an argument to suggest that we can't really call 1945 particularly a year of peace. It's not where, you know, one war ended, but certainly other wars continued to rage across the continent. And a kind of unofficial war against European Germans certainly took place in 1945. Germans who had either found themselves exported to the east by Hitler, or ethnic Germans who inhabited parts of Czechoslovakia, parts of Hungary, and ethnic Germans who lived in the Baltic states, were understandably not very welcome by their host countries following the acts of Hitler across Europe, and were summarily expelled. Stalin's rearranging of the borders of Poland, so that he took the slice of Poland that he had already claimed during the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. If you want more on that, look at the podcast earlier on. It was a couple of months ago I did it on the Nazi-Soviet Pact. And the Poles were compensated by a chunk of East Germany that was given to them at the Yalta Conference, from which obviously ethnic Germans were expelled. So there is an enormous amount of suffering on the part of ethnic Germans in the immediate post-war period, as they are expelled from across Europe. The lucky ones make it back to the West, the not-so-lucky ones wind up in East Germany under communist rule. In certain parts of Europe, civil wars had been raging throughout the duration of the Second World War and were continuing to do so. In Yugoslavia, the Croat fascists under Ante Pavic, who had allied themselves with Hitler, suddenly found themselves on the losing side against the more Serb and Bosnian.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Based communist forces led by Tito, the Croat fascists had inflicted with their fascist party, the Ustaše, horrific crimes against the Serbs and against the Jews in Yugoslavia. And they were now obviously on the receiving end of violence and retribution. And many Croats who were innocent of any crimes also had to flee Yugoslavia and head westwards as quickly as possible. From 1945 onwards, a British presence in Greece became an integral part of the Greek Civil War, which raged until 1949. The British departed in 1947, realizing that they were unable to continue financially supporting the Greek government and financially supporting a military occupation there. But the war that took place in Greece between the Titoist communist partisans and the Greek government led to a continuation of violence and bloodshed within the Balkans, within the part of the East Mediterranean, and was a direct result of the kind of the politics of the early Cold War era. Churchill had committed himself to Greece. It's not certain why specifically Greece was of interest to Churchill, perhaps because, as we discussed previously in the Yalta Conference podcast, Churchill's ambitions for a free and democratic and, more importantly, non-communist Poland don't really come off. So Greece is perhaps where Churchill felt he could make his stand. Many other governments in Europe saw it as an opportunity to have some quick and convenient population exchanges. Europe becomes an awfully lot more ethnically homogenous. European countries become more ethnically homogenous in 1945. You know, Bulgaria shipping 160,000 Turks out of their territory to Turkey. The Czechs swap 120,000 Slovaks, the Czechoslovakians, I beg your pardon, exchange 120,000 Slovaks living in Hungary for an equivalent number of Hungarians living in Slovakia. On the previous point about Germany, I think it's important to realise the scale of the expulsions. In Czechoslovakia alone, only there were 3 million Germans expelled, of which about a tenth died in the expulsions, which were not a peaceful process in any way, shape or form at all. Their property was expropriated, and the property fell into the hands of the new communist regimes. And much of this had been agreed at the wartime conferences. The exiled governments of the Czechs, and these were not communist party members from Czechoslovakia and Hungary and places like that, but nationalists and liberals and Democrats. These were the people at the wartime conferences, such as Yalta and Potsdam, who insisted on an ethnic cleansing of Germans from their territories, the solving of the German problem. One of the chief proponents of this solving of the German problem in Czechoslovakia was Edvard Beneš, who had been betrayed really by the West during the Munich Agreement of 1938. Few borders, with the exception of Poland, were actually rearranged, and so it was people that were shunted around more than geographical borders, which is an interesting parallel with the end of the First World War, really, in that at the end of the First World War, the peacemakers at Versailles redrew the map and left the people largely where they were. At the end of the Second World War, the politics of Stalin and Hitler and the kind of the demographic politics really of Stalin and Hitler tend to prevail, and it is populations that are shunted around or expelled. And this is kind of gives us an insight into the brutalization of war, the extent to which war had made revenge and retribution a major priority, and the extent to which a war which was in part based on nationalism and national identity and ethnicity, those values seem to translate on into the post-war era, where people are still defining themselves in a kind of a racially tribalist way across Europe, kicking out minorities and removing peoples who they found were possibly dangerous and subversive. The United Nations Relief and Recovery Agency, as I said earlier, should be kind of acknowledged for its impressive achievements. In Germany alone, there were 227 relief camps set up to organise the relief efforts for millions of displaced peoples in Germany, forced workers, slaves, survivors of the Holocaust and the other camps, prisoners of war, and other people who were displaced by the chaos of war. There's another 762 camps across the rest of Europe, and the attempts that they went to trace relatives, to find a place for peoples to go to, and to resettle people in countries where they were going to be safe, it is really quite staggering. And there is a legacy of this which has lasted through through much of the kind of the humanitarian work of the United Nations ever since. There were nearly 7 million civilians being cared for and repatriated by the United Nations. And the Soviets had probably about another 7 million people falling under their authority. The largest number of displaced peoples were from the Soviet Union. There were something like about 1.5 million Poles, 350,000 Czechs, 300,000 Belgians, 300,000 Dutch, 700,000 Italians, all who had been sucked into the Reich as forced labourers and prisoners of war, and had been treated pretty abominably in the slave labour camps of Nazi Germany. The problem of displaced persons who are considered to have somewhere to go and the problem of refugees is obviously slightly different. And in 1946, the International Refugee Organization was established to deal with this issue too. There were returning citizens from all sorts, all European countries, who for one reason or another were unable or unwilling to return to their home countries. The majority of French and Italians liberated were home within 4 to 6 weeks, whereas people who were liberated in western parts of the Nazi Empire, but who had been taken from the east, such as Poles or Lithuanians or people from the Soviet Union, very often didn't wish to return to now the Soviet-occupied countries that they had once inhabited, or were prevented from doing so. And the question of what to do with these people was would be a vexed one indeed. The Allies, in the space of 2 years, from 1945 to 47, sent back about 2.3 million Soviet citizens to the East, even though in many instances these were people who were begging to not be repatriated. They were well aware that men who had fought for Stalin and had been captured as prisoners by the Germans were likely to wind up in the gulags or to suffer an even worse fate. And people that had been taken as forced workers to the to Nazi Germany were seen as traitors as well. So perhaps there was a lack of understanding in the West. Perhaps this is the sympathetic way of looking at the British and the Americans that loaded desperate Soviet citizens onto cattle trucks and sent them eastwards. Or possibly there was an understanding that the war was now over, that what happened in the Soviet Union was no longer Britain's business, and that Britain had no desire or interest in becoming involved or testing the new tense atmosphere of the Cold War. I suspect that might be closer to the truth. Anyway, okay, I'm going to end this cheery podcast here. If you are a student of the Cold War, as I know many people are, we're going to be doing a Cold War special podcast in the next few days, looking at three phases of the Cold War, and looking at how you can do your, how you can sort of chunk it down, break it down, and understand these three phases of the Cold War, and it's going to do an awful lot to help you craft essays, so make sure you tune into that. If you are also studying Nazi Germany, I've got a brilliant new ebook out at the moment, make sure you get it. It is Julia Routledge's The Genocidal Century, featuring the Jewish Holocaust and the other significant mass killings of the 20th century, looking at it in a kind of a broad thematic way. It's a brilliant ebook. I'll put the link below this podcast. And we are coming up to the 100th edition of the Explaining History podcast. So keep your ears out. There will be a special exciting giveaway. And I'm going to be announcing that on the next podcast. So thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.